Remembering a Founding Father today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Shimon Peres died today. He played a crucial role in creating the State of Israel and served as both prime minister and president. But he always said political opinion polls are like perfume.
Nice to smell, dangerous to swallow. I have to make up my mind as a responsible man and take risks.
Not everyone liked the risks Peres took, though.
He would cover up the war crimes that were going on by putting on this international talk about the need for peace and the desire for peace.
And later, Peggy's Cove, Nova Scotia, has gone viral thanks to a couple of dancers.
It was one of those random things we usually do, right? We just go anywhere and start dancing.
The story's coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Glad you could make it here today. You know, as long as I've been reading the news, the international news story, the mother of all protracted conflicts, the test case for whether peace is possible anywhere, has been the Middle East. If peace could happen there, then it could happen, you'd think, anywhere. Today, one of the key actors in the search for Mideast peace died, former Israeli leader Shimon Peres. We're going to spend some time on the show today asking what that means for Israelis, for Palestinians, and for peace. In 1994, Peres shared a Nobel Peace Prize with Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. The Nobel recognized their roles in the Oslo Peace Accords, a deal negotiated secretly in Oslo that was the most promising hope for Mideast peace, even if peace itself has proved elusive since then. But Peres stayed committed to the cause, as he explained in 2013.
People are sick and tired of wars and terror. And when you look at the polls on both parties, you see a majority for peace. So we have to continue and try. That's it.
We'll hear more from that interview with Peres later on The World. Right now, I want to turn to Dina Kraft, who worked as a journalist in Israel for more than 10 years. She says Peres was a fixture in Israel ever since the nation was born in 1948.
Shimon Peres was in public life for about 70 years, so there was almost never a time that current Israelis can remember him not being around. I mean, he was there in the early days, one of Ben-Gurion's personal sort of entourage of advisors. He was sort of selected.
David Ben-Gurion, the founder of modern Israel.
Exactly. So he's the last living link to David Ben-Gurion. He helped create the nuclear program in the south of Israel. He was, you know, had roles in intelligence and elsewhere in Israel, and he was part of public life from the time he was a teenager. He came to Israel as a young boy from Poland, and he never lost that Polish accent of his. Mm. He still had this very thick Polish accent, and he was sort of a tie to a different type of politician and a leader, and a tie to a different time as well, when Israel was founding and was starting and sort of had a vision and hope. And he had that vision and hope, which he carried with him to the peace negotiation table as one of the important figures in forging the Oslo peace process with Rabin and with Arafat.
I mean, it is pretty remarkable when you think about it that at least one of Israel's founding fathers from 1948 lived until 2016. What would you say was his biggest single contribution to the story of Israel?
I think it's hard to narrow it down to one thing. I think he'll be most remembered, though, as a sort of voice of hope for peace, a vision. You know, Israel's a place today that feels very dark. It feels without real sort of any hope for any kind of real dramatic breakthrough with the Palestinians. But he always carried this mantle of hope and peace and this idea that the future could be different. He was very youth-focused. He's also very focused on Israel as a tech economy. Back when no one knew what Facebook was, he was touting Facebook. Facebook was this place for connection and people. He managed to keep this very youthful vigor about him despite his age. And I think people couldn't really ever imagine him not being part of Israel because he was for so long. There's a Israeli satirical show that's a little bit like Saturday Night Live. And on its 60th anniversary special, they had Peres. They were doing Israel Imagine the Future, 100th birthday of Israel. And Peres was still there and vital and kicking, and he was still in office. I mean, it was just so part of the fabric of the country. But I think he's going to be most missed for being able to talk about peace without it sounding hokey, to talk about peace and to still have some sense that it might actually happen and there could be a different future, even when things feel bleak. And now there's no one really to pick up that torch and pick up that mantle. I think Israelis are feeling a little bit lost without him today.
How do you reconcile this idea that he was strong on peacemaking? That is kind of his reputation. But also, he had this deep involvement in the military and was kind of hawkish.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in his early days, he was hawkish, very much so. And he also, don't forget, it was under his government that the first settlements in the West Bank began. And so, you know, he's very much tied up with the problems that we have today and the sort of intractable nature of it. But I think like many political leaders, especially as they get older and especially from a vantage of being in charge, quote unquote, they start seeing how, you know, intractable the war was and how conflict is not the answer and you can't have a Spartan state forever. How do you maintain that? And how can you feed your country just on militarism?
Dina, you met and interviewed Shimon Peres several times. What was your impression of him as a man?
I mean, very warm and personable, sort of a sparkle in his eye. He really liked public life. He really liked being on. When I interviewed him in South Africa, when I was based there, he'd come in for a UN conference. I remember he looked tired. He looked fatigued. But as soon as the lights went on of the camera, as soon as he was on and rolling, he sort of came to life again. And then when the cameras went off, I could see him sort of sinking back into his chair again a little bit, looking more his age, shall we say.
Dina Krau, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Dina Krau spent more than 10 years in Israel as a journalist. She now directs the Media Innovation Program at Northeastern University here in Boston. Leaders from around the globe have been offering their condolences today for Shimon Peres. They describe him as a giant, a statesman, and a man of peace. But as the world's Matthew Bell reports, the Palestinian view is different.
The president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, put out a statement that called Shimon Peres a partner for peace. Abbas said Peres worked with the late Palestinian president Yasser Arafat to reach a long-lasting peace until the last breath. But that's not the first thing that comes to mind if you ask most Palestinians about the late Israeli leader.
He is the founder of the Israeli settlement enterprise.
That's Sam Bahur, a Palestinian-American businessman in Ramallah in the West Bank. He left Youngstown, Ohio, where he grew up, in the early 1990s, when lots of people believed that peace was possible for Palestinians and Israelis.
I actually went to Tel Aviv University in Israel and got an MBA. Peres was there when I got the MBA and, you know, shook my hand after the graduation ceremony.
Bahur says there was a buzz in the air created by the Oslo Agreement that Peres helped bring about with Israel's Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. But then, one night in early November 1995, a Jewish extremist murdered Rabin.
He and Peres were at the same event, and that was the end of what I believe the buzz. And from that point on, it's been a downhill spiral ever since.
Now, Bahur says he will always remember Shimon Peres as someone who created the Israeli military, developed Israel's nuclear weapons program, and expanded Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. When it came to peace, Bahur says Peres could certainly talk the talk.
He had become a professional fig leaf for the Israeli society. He would cover up the war crimes that were going on and continue to go on by putting on this international talk about the need for peace and the desire for peace. But he did not enact policy on the ground. He did not restrain the military when he could. Just the opposite. What he did is more important than what he said.
One Palestinian official I spoke with this morning would not talk on tape, but expressed something similar. This official said, the death of Shimon Peres comes long after the death of the peace process, and that Peres was responsible for beautifying what is really a very ugly reality for Palestinians. A spokesman with the Islamic militant group Hamas that rules over the Gaza Strip was willing to go on the record. Sami Abu Zuhri told the BBC that Peres was the last of his generation, one of the co-founders of the Israeli occupation, and that his death marks the beginning of a new era of weakness and retreat for the Zionist entity. Abu Zuhri said Palestinians are happy that this, quote, criminal is gone because he has blood on his hands. That's something people on the street in Ramallah today were quick to mention as well. This man, Halim Jaber, told Reuters that Shimon Peres might be seen as a moderate leader, but he killed many Palestinians. And that is something businessman Sam Bahur says will always be part of the legacy of Peres.
I mean, no one likes to see anyone pass away. I mean, regardless of the politics, regardless of what we think of a person. However, we have to understand that this is a 50-year military occupation.
For Israelis, Peres was a statesman like no other. But for Palestinians, that might just add to their skepticism. If a political giant like Peres could not bring an end to the conflict, it's hard to see who can. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
We'll have more on Shimon Peres and his legacy later on the show. Right now, I want to switch gears a little and ask you this. When does a harmless cartoon frog become a nasty, racist, and anti-Semitic cartoon frog that has to be called out? Well, right now, actually, according to the Anti-Defamation League, or ADL, the cartoon in question is Pepe the Frog. For years, it existed peacefully online as a popular meme. But the ADL just added Pepe the Frog to its list of hate symbols, a database of images most frequently used by white supremacist groups. Just to give you the idea, the swastika and Confederate battle flag are also on that list. Oren Siegel is the director of the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism. So why has the ADL declared Pepe the Frog to be a hate symbol?
Well, when you look at internet memes, oftentimes they start off, you know, rather unoffensive. They're for fun. What we've seen over the past several months is an increase in this particular meme of Pepe the Frog being used by white supremacists and bigots of all kinds. Because of the volume of the hatred and the efforts to use it to harass people online, we felt it was time to add Pepe the Frog to our database.
So give us a few examples of how Pepe the Frog has been used, or rather retreaded, shall we say.
Pepe the Frog is used commonly by alt-right types or white supremacists who take the imagery behind it and then add, you know, references to the Nazis, to Hitler, basically using any possible offensive stereotype and overlaying that onto what used to be an innocent meme. What they do, though, beyond sort of maybe putting a Hitler mustache on a frog or putting this frog in front of a concentration camp, is the use of it. Those images have tended to target Jews and maybe perceived Jews and others in an effort to intimidate and harass.
I'm looking at one drawing right now online. It's Pepe the Frog with a Donald Trump hairdo, and he's peering through the U.S. border, and there are two Mexicans on the other side who can't come through, and the frog is smiling. And another one, he's at first looking at the World Trade Center's on fire. The second plane goes in, and he's wearing a yarmulke, by the way, in this one, and the side curls, and then he turns around and he smiles after the second plane crashes. So clearly, it's being used in many different contexts.
That's right. And I mean, that's the thing about memes these days, is that, you know, anybody can take part in creating new hateful types of messages and iconography by, you know, sharing it, adding to it, and trying to distribute it to people online.
It was a comic artist, Matt Fury, who created Pepe the Frog, the character, around 2005, one of the characters in his comic series Boys Club. And since then, the frog has come to mean everything from pleasure to sadness. Nicki Minaj has used Pepe the Frog to tweet various things. Why declare the entire image a hate symbol then?
The idea behind memes is that they often can take, you know, thousands of different forms. So instead of selecting the Pepe the Frog with the Hitler mustache, or the Pepe the Frog standing in front of a burning World Trade Center, what we decided was to take the meme in its totality and say, there are still many uses of this meme that are not offensive, that are meant to be fun, that are used by people who have no ill intent whatsoever. But because of the volume and the amount of memes that we're seeing that do have this more hateful underpinning, we felt it was important to let people know that that too is happening. Listen, I don't think this is the last chapter for Pepe the Frog. I think there's a possibility that he will be reclaimed and that the positive uses of this meme will outweigh those negative ones. But for now, Pepe the Frog is being used and abused in ways that are just unacceptable.
Oren Siegel, the director of the Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism. Thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We have a story now about Christians in the Middle East. With all the turmoil in Syria and Iraq, many Christians there have fled the violence and persecution, hoping to get to the U.S. But recently, The World's Richard Hall met an American couple who went in the opposite direction. They traveled to Lebanon to work as Christian missionaries.
It's not often that I run into Texans in Lebanon. So when I met Kim and David a few weeks ago, I couldn't help asking them what brought them here. We are missionaries, they told me, sent here by God to help refugees who fled the war in Syria. They didn't want me to use their last name, but they did invite me to the school they founded. They call it the House of Love. Kim and David came here to Lebanon 2 years ago on a short trip to help Syrian refugees. It was during that visit that Kim said God told her to move here permanently. But Kim figured David wouldn't do it. He had a good job in the States.
I thought, oh God, you're going to have to like part the Red Sea or something for him because I don't see him budging.
But David also felt the call, as he put it. They packed up all of their stuff and told their 8 kids, all fully grown, that they were going to Lebanon. The Bekaa Valley. In case you're not familiar with it, the Bekaa Valley is one of those places that the State Department says Americans should avoid entirely.
You know, if you pull up on the government website, they have the red warning. It's all red.
It's close to the border with Syria. And just a couple of weeks ago, a bomb went off a mile down the road from the school.
Of course, you think about those things, but then you have to weigh out. First of all, did I sign up to be a follower of Christ to be safe? Or to be happy, or, you know, personally, I don't see him as a Santa Claus.
Kim and David are providing education for the Syrian kids here, many of whom haven't been in school for years. But they're also doing something else. This song is called Jesus is My Sugar. After classes in English and Arabic, the kids watch videos to learn about the Bible. This one shows Jesus surrounded by adoring children. Most of the kids at the school are Sunni Muslims. I'll be honest, when I first heard about what Kim and David were doing here, my first thought was, do these guys know what they're getting into? Lebanon has a sizable Christian population, but the relationship between Christians and Muslims here is complicated, to say the least. Missionaries have been targeted here in the past, even killed. Beyond the extremists, there are many in the Muslim community who don't look kindly upon Christian evangelizing. But despite the Bible videos, Kim and David insist that converting Muslims is not their aim.
We are not here to convert anyone. Now, the families around us that bring their kids here, they know that we are Christians from the States. And they're okay with that. We let them know, look, it's going to be in the way we teach morals and values. And are you okay with that? Of course. And if they're not, then they don't come.
Yeah. And so the kids have these lessons, so they go back and talk to their parents about what they've seen.
Of course.
Do you get any feedback from the parents at all about it?
Mostly positive.
It surprises me a bit. I thought that you might get a bit of pushback on that.
Well, there are some in the community that probably don't want their kids. But again, it's by choice they come here.
They say they haven't had any major problems with locals here. Though David does mention that they had to move the site of the school after they first arrived, because it was in a predominantly Muslim neighborhood.
We had to move from there because of all of the kind of the tensions that were being created.
One of the volunteers here at the House of Love converted to Christianity shortly before coming to Lebanon. I'll call him Christopher. He's a Kurd from a conservative Muslim family in northern Iraq. He started reading the Bible after a Christian friend of his was killed fighting ISIS.
My father bought the Bible, I bought a new one, and then after 1 week he checked my stuff, and then he found another one. So he tried to kill me because it's like a shame or something like this.
I asked Christopher what would happen if one of the Muslim kids here wanted to convert.
Do you ever worry that they might get in trouble with their families like you did if they go home and talk to their parents about Jesus?
Yeah, of course. That's why we are in a first step just talking through the story and a movie about Jesus. But we don't tell them what they should do. We are just showing. So they're going to decide it, not us.
Given the sensitivity of the issue, I asked Kim and David why not just support a local charity in their work with refugees, maybe avoid some of these problems. They said they thought about it, but they didn't feel at peace with that option. It wasn't what they were called here to do. For The World, Richard Hall, the Bekaa Valley, Lebanon.
Bhangra, a style of music and dance that's popular in the Punjab region of India. But a new Bhangra video that went viral has a very different backdrop. Picturesque Peggy's Cove in the Canadian province of Nova Scotia. On the video, you see two men dancing on a big granite ledge in front of the Atlantic Ocean. Hasmeet Singh is one of those dancers. He's with the Maritime Bhangra Group of Halifax.
It was one of those random things we usually do, right? We just go anywhere and start dancing. And we'll make a small clip out of it and just put it there. And this was posted on September 23rd. And I mean, I would say in first few hours, we saw like people are taking a lot of interest in this, and we were very happy. And we were like, okay, this is going to go. We usually get like 300 to 500 views. And we thought this is going to go maybe 1,000 or 1,500. And it looks like it's going to go 300,000 in a few more minutes.
Wow. So what's it like to receive all this attention?
Trust me, we are really very, very, very happy. And we are, and the first and foremost thing, we are thankful to the people who have done this, because we know we don't do anything special. You have teams in Boston, you have teams in Toronto, you have teams in Vancouver who do much better stuff than what we do.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, there are plenty of Bhangra clips online. It's not like you guys did the first one, but why do you think your clip kind of caught on fire?
To be honest, I think it's the first factor is Peggy Skoll and the Rocks, because people living in Halifax and Nova Scotia or somewhere on East Coast, they always try to relate themselves to that ocean, you know. And when they see rocks, they just kind of feel connected through their ancestors, through their family members, and the time they have spent there with their family.
So 300,000 views, I mean, what does that actually mean? Does that mean you think that people are connecting to you and your culture? Are they entertained? What do those numbers actually suggest?
I think the first thing is entertainment. They feel happy. And the second thing is, the reason why we do this is we want to let people know our culture. And because we all are from Sikh faith, and the name of our religion is Sikhism. So when we move on the streets, people look at us, people see like we wear different clothes. We have a different appearance from a normal guy. You know, we wear a big turban on our head. So we just wanted to let people know who we are and, you know, why we look like this. That was one reason why we did this. And the other would be we wanted to attract people to Nova Scotia. You know, this is such a wonderful province and we have great people over here.
Yeah, elaborate on that a bit. When it comes to learning about other cultures, what do you think dance does that music or, say, food can't communicate?
I think dance is much of an expressive thing. Like, as I say, actions say more than words, right? So when you are doing a specific thing and you have a typical meaning attached to it, it brings more attention. It gives them a level, or I would say a part of it where they can connect with us.
Hasmeet Singh with the Maritime Bhangra Group. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
News headlines are coming up in about a minute here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Physicist Rainer Weiss changed the way we see the universe. And it all began when he was an immigrant kid rummaging through spare parts.
What happens if you buy a whole box full of transformers, another box full of capacitors, radar sets half disassembled? So I was able to get all sorts of junk like that. And I started making all sorts of stuff.
The full story ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. When we talk about America's founding fathers, we're talking about towering figures from centuries ago. It's been different in Israel because those who founded the State of Israel in 1948 were also part of the country's modern political landscape. No longer, though, perhaps the last of that generation of Israeli leaders, Shimon Peres, died today. The former prime minister and president was 93. Former U.S. Special Envoy to the Mideast, Dennis Ross, stepped into Peres's world relatively late in the game in 1986. Later, Ross was part of the secret negotiations between the U.S., Israel, and the Palestinians in Oslo, Norway. It was only then, he says, that he saw the full extent of Shimon Peres as a diplomatic dealmaker.
You know, one of the striking things about Shimon is that the image of many in Israel was that he was not a tough negotiator, but in fact, he was a strategic negotiator. He was someone I would describe as not a checkers player in negotiations, but a chess player. He was always thinking 3-4 steps ahead. He also felt that you needed to try to create win-win situations, that the point was not to produce an outcome that was very good for Israel, but terrible for the Palestinians. It had to be something that could work for both. He was mindful of the political constraints on both sides, but he also was very mindful of wanting to have something that he hoped could work, even as he had his own doubts. And he would look at Arafat, and he understood that Arafat had been a revolutionary kind of leader who who found it difficult to dispense with, in fact, those revolutionary instincts. And Peres was constantly trying to bring him along and emphasize to him everything that could be gained and what a Palestinian state could become.
Were you clear in how determined Shimon Peres was in getting to peace? I mean, these were secret negotiations in Oslo, a chess game. Your metaphor is very internal. Was he at all transparent?
With us and with me in particular, yes, he was transparent. There were different moments, I mean, striking moments, by the way, when the interim agreement, which is the most important of all the Oslo agreements, was concluded. I say the most important because it created the rudiments of a state by bringing the Palestinian Authority to the West Bank. And he was under a lot of pressure from within his own cabinet, but at the same time, he was very open about what he was trying to do, recognizing the difficulties. At one point, I still recall him saying to me, it's funny how those who are never at the table always think they know best how to negotiate. It was striking to me because I had felt it throughout my career that it's always easier when you're not at the table. You always know what's best, and yet those who are at the table are the ones who are actually having to make the hard decisions, having to figure out how to make adjustments where you can and where to hold the line where you must.
Well, he was pushing for peace, but he's also being pulled by colleagues back in Israel, and he had a hawkish side. Do you think that minimized his peacemaking abilities?
I don't think so. In some ways, it was precisely because of who he was. He was a guy who actually had built the Israeli defense ministry. It's one of the great ironies, as I've said and written elsewhere, that Shimon Peres, as a man in his late 20s, was the one who built the Israeli defense ministry and establishment. And yet, because he never actually formally served in the Israeli military, that was always held against him. But his understanding of strategic and security issues was profound. It gave him grounding as to what Israel could afford to do, but it also gave him a perspective on why trying to produce peace in the end could be something that could meet Israel's long-term strategic needs and also transform the region, which he always had uppermost in his mind.
Ambassador Dennis Ross, what memory of Shimon Peres will be most lasting for you? The man, a memory of the man.
Well, I'll tell you, this is an astounding experience in some ways to recall. I was having lunch with him a little over a year ago, private lunch, just the two of us. And what did he want to focus on that whole time? He wanted to focus on the new research that he was reading about research into the brain and how we weren't fulfilling all the capabilities we had, but these breakthroughs in understanding how the brain functioned was not only important for opening up everyone's horizon and being able to achieve much more, but also what it would mean in terms of advances in medicine. So here he was, a 92-year-old man, focused entirely on the future, excited by this prospect of these breakthroughs, and feeling and thinking about all the things that could be done with it and how he might try to take advantage of it. I was just struck that this man who was 92 years old was very youthful in terms of his outlook and his excitement about new horizons. He never tired of looking at those new horizons, and in some ways, it was really his emblem.
Ambassador Ross, thank you very much for your thoughts about Shimon Peres. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ambassador Dennis Ross was special Middle East coordinator for President Bill Clinton. He worked with Shimon Peres on the Oslo Peace Accords. We spent a lot of time today on The World talking about Shimon Peres, but we also want to take a few minutes now to listen to him. Back in 2013, my BBC colleague Lise Doucette interviewed Peres on his 90th birthday. He was still on the job as president of Israel back then. Peres told Lise that he believed in working towards finding peace with the Palestinians.
Because all parties, both the Arabs and the Druze, know they don't have an alternative but blood. And people are sick and tired of wars and terror. And when you look at the polls on both parties, you see a majority for peace. So what we have is to find the right technicalities, the right ways how to overcome prejudices, suspicions, which all are human in human nature.
Many are saying time is running out.
Maybe they are. So time is out. What to do? Time is out. We are not out. Life is not out. So I have to continue and try. That's it.
But if opinion polls have any value, the last one by Gallup said that 52% of Israelis were ready to accept a Palestinian state, 40% wouldn't, which means that the nation is divided on whether there should be a two-state solution.
The polls are moody. And when you asked, I'm not sure that people are answering what they have in their heart. Occasionally they have party considerations. I say that polls is like perfume. Nice to smell, dangerous to swallow. I'm not impressed by it. I have to make up my mind as a responsible man and take risks and know that you cannot achieve peace in one jump. You can achieve war, yes, very easily. So, I mean, I'm not impressed by it. And I know if I'm not ready to be controversial, I'm not ready to move ahead.
And your biggest wish now, at the age of 90, as you celebrate your 90th birthday?
I don't celebrate 90. But what sort of celebration is it to get a year older? I mean, it's nonsense in my judgment. But if people want to use it for good purposes, why not? Why not? It made many people happy. It was a celebration. I enjoy it too, but to say that for that I would invest the efforts, no.
No regrets?
Never in my life. From time to time, I'm sorry, but never regret.
What's the secret of your energy? What keeps you going?
My secret of energy is simple. I use it. You have energy, as I do, as everybody does. But, you know, people have occasionally too much pity about themselves. So they become lazy. And, you know, people say you have to go to vacation. Why should I? I enjoy working more than vacation.
But you're the oldest president in the world, and in some countries it would be unthinkable to have a president at the age of 90.
Well, you want me to ask for an excuse? That happened. I didn't do anything exceptional. I worked. I'm engaged. I'm curious. I'm interested. And I'm really enjoying life. I like people. I like their company. I know it's difficult, but what is the alternative? And I know also that if you try, you achieve many things. Your life is becoming meaningful. That's the greatest thing you can achieve in your life. The alternative is to be bored. A person who is bored is a person who is dead. I'm never bored in my life.
The late Shimon Peres speaking there to my BBC colleague Lise Doucette in 2013 when he was president of Israel. Not long after, he stepped down from that office and recorded a very funny video about what, at the age of 90, he'd do with the next chapter in his life. The video also shows what a lovely sense of humor he had. We've posted it on our Facebook page. Just look for PRI The World on Facebook. Let's get an update now on one terrible moment in the war in eastern Ukraine. In 2014, in the early months of the Russian incursion into Ukraine, Malaysia Airlines passenger flight MH17 flew over the area and was shot down. All 298 people on board, mostly Dutch citizens on their way to Malaysia, were killed. It's long been suspected that a Russian missile brought it down. Russia has consistently denied responsibility, blaming Ukrainian government forces instead. But now a Dutch-led team of international criminal investigators has released their report that says they know Russia did this. Reporter Charles Maines joins me from Moscow. So these latest findings follow an earlier Dutch report. What have these investigators turned up?
Well, you know, if the earlier report, this is by the Dutch Safety Board, was a civilian committee, it determined that there had been a Buk surface-to-air missile system fired on the plane. But essentially, it just determined what we already knew, that this plane had been shot down. This time, we had this international team of prosecutors, as you note, who found that the missile had not only come from Russia, it was fired from rebel-held territory and then had been returned. This is the actual missile battery system, been returned to Russia following the crash. So we got a much more complete picture of how this happened. And, you know, it goes from everything from using phone intercepts. It also tapped social media postings that really traced the path of this Russian Buk missile system, as it's called, as it made its way into East Ukraine and then back.
I mean, this seems to be solid evidence. It was a Russian missile, and the report identifies 100 people. They say actively helped carry out the operation, if we can call it that. What's the Kremlin doing with this news?
Well, they're reacting with a lot of anger. Essentially, we had kind of down the spectrum from Moscow here comments on this. The Russian Foreign Ministry called the conclusions of this investigation politically motivated and biased. They note the fact that Russia is not a participant in the member nations that are part of this investigation, and that's true. They accuse Ukraine, who is a member of this investigation team, of fabricating evidence. They say that Russian evidence has been ignored. We have President Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, insisted that this report is speculation, and that essentially that the investigative team ignored new Russian radar location data that implicated Ukrainian forces, and essentially shows that there was no rocket fired from the east side where rebels held territory. And this is a pattern we've seen with the Russians. They essentially roll out a new version of events just as the Dutch are getting ready to unveil theirs.
Yeah, and what about Russian media? Is that kind of also the Kremlin too? How the Russian media covering this?
Well, yeah, it's been pretty condemning in terms of the report that essentially the fix is in and that the evidence is just isn't there. The Russian version of events is being completely ignored. So I think there's a lot of sense that this is just being distorted from the beginning.
You know, we just saw today the reversal of a presidential veto at the White House to a bill that would have allowed American families who lost loved ones on 9/11 from suing the Saudis. Now those families can do that. Is there any sign that Dutch families would want to sue Moscow over MH17, either in a criminal or civil suit?
Well, it's a good question because, I mean, at this point, this investigation made no conclusions as to who gave these orders to move the weapon or who shot this weapon into the air. So we don't know that. As you noted earlier, that the investigative team said there is a group of 100 people of interest. They're not calling them suspects just yet. But I think that the legal sort of underpinnings of this are not entirely clear. But one thing seems to be clear at this point, and that's Russia's really digging its heels in on this. In some ways, I remember when we talked about this the last time, there was a report that came out, and it was reminiscent of the way that, you take the Soviet experience of the massacre of Katyn. This is when the Soviet Union massacred Polish soldiers in World War II. It took 40 or 50 years before the Soviets acknowledged that because, they're just too invested into this. And I suspect you're not going to see any change from the Russian side in terms of acknowledgement of any kind until there's a different leader, a different government here.
Yeah, so where do things go from here, Charles? Where can things go if Russians are digging their heels in?
Well, again, they're going to move forward with the investigation. They've got now another 2-year mandate. I imagine they'll start looking at some of these suspects or persons of interest, as they're calling them. And it was noted by the investigative team today that they're going to look at some legal framework to try and develop it, at least, so that they can look at prosecutions. They're promising justice in some form. It was interesting. There was a comment on Twitter by a Russian lawyer. His name is Mark Fagan. And he was saying this was a real disservice that essentially the investigative team had named the fact that they had these 100 people in mind. He had an ominous warning that essentially these people were now marked men, that their time was limited because if they knew too much, that they were inconvenient.
Wow. Our friend, reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks for the update, Charles.
Thank you, Marco.
Next week, you might want to keep your phone close by your side. Beginning Monday, calls will go out to the 2016 Nobel Prize winners. Tuesday's award will recognize a discovery in the world of physics, and Rainer Weiss, an MIT professor emeritus, is a strong contender. Weiss dreamed up the idea behind a laser observatory known as LIGO. It's a sort of massive antenna, so sensitive it detects faint, invisible ripples in space from 1.3 billion years ago. Weiss discovered his love of science as a kid growing up in Berlin. His mother was a German actress. His father was a Jewish doctor and a communist. When the Nazis rose to power, the family fled Germany. They were staying in a hotel in the Tatra Mountains of Slovakia in 1938 when Rainer says they realized Europe was no longer safe.
This hotel was full of Jews and people who had been Germans, expatriate Germans who had crossed the border to get away from Hitler. And what happened is there was this wonderful Gothic-looking radio that was sitting in the foyer of that hotel, and it had tubes in it. To me, that was very fascinating, to look in the back of the thing. But some
and
awful
those tubes
stuff.
Glowed, too.
Yeah, they glow, and they were hot, and they made little sparkly things. Oh, it was just wonderful. And I was 6 or something like that. But what was really going on was very serious. That was coming out of the front of the radio, and there was a whole bunch of people listening to it. And that was Neville Chamberlain giving away, effectively, Czechoslovakia to Hitler to avoid a world war. And that place emptied out overnight.
Wow.
And everybody raced to Prague to try to get out. And not many made it. And the thing is, only people who were professionals. The Americans were no better than the Canadians, no better than the Australians. Nobody wanted any Jews. The hell with them. Okay, that was Hitler was bad, but the other world, the rest of the world wasn't as bad, but they were pretty awful too.
You and your family, you were lucky.
We
made
got
it to New York
and
in
we
1939.
Got out for a very special reason. There's a family in St. Louis, the Stix family, that ran a department store, and they gave bond to the American government. They said, look, we'll take 10,000 Jews, and if they get into trouble, we'll pay for them, which was remarkable. Just imagine such a thing.
Well, we're kind of living through this whole experience again today in many ways. Were you welcomed when you arrived in New York in 1939, you and your family?
Yes, of course we were. We were considered more Germans. And for I think my mother made a wonderful mistake sending me to public school in Lederhosen. And this was the day the Germans bombed Rotterdam. Okay, so the teacher and all the kids, you know, they read the paper, and here's this damn German. Oh, my God. You know, that was the only time I ever sensed any hostility.
So, Ray Weiss, that's kind of the background. And moving into what you do today, I'm a radio person, obviously. I'm also a music lover. And I was fascinated to find out that a lot of your interest in hearing what's in space began with you listening to records and trying to figure out how to get the snap and crackle and pop out of the vinyl. What kind of things did you do to solve that problem? You were a kid.
You have to remember the times again. This was now a little later, but by that time I was probably 12 or so. And the war was over, and the streets of New York, especially downtown New York, were loaded with stuff coming back as war surplus stuff. And you go down to Cortlandt Street in New York, which no longer exists. It was near the World Trade Center.
Right.
And what happens, you go here, the whole box full of transformers, another box full of capacitors, vacuum tubes, everything you could ever want, radar sets half dissembled. As a kid, that was mind-boggling. You bought stuff for nothing at all. If you could lug it down the subway home, you got it. So I was able to get all sorts of junk like that. And I started making all sorts of stuff, radios, hi-fi sets, which didn't exist, you know. And I was very lucky. There was a movie theater in Brooklyn had a fire behind the screen. If you went down there and unscrewed the loudspeakers that are behind the screen, you could have them. So I took them home. I got some six or seven of them home. And they're heavy. They're real big loudspeakers. Then I had a wonderful setup because three things were happening simultaneously. FM radio was coming in. Good amplifier circuits were around. I mean, I copied other people's circuits. What did I know, right? And so what happened is I built something, and I would invite some of the emigres, because who were there, very interesting music, come over and listen to this. We would hear the New York Philharmonic, and these people were just blown away. I mean, imagine. They said, we're like in the concert hall. And so they wanted one. And so little by little, this thing grew into a business.
You were kind of there at the start of the audiophile revolution.
That's right. If I had not gone to college, I probably could have made some money, you know. But what got me to go to college was the problem that you raised. Everything was wonderful on the if you had an FM set, but vinyl wasn't there yet. It was shellac records that made that horrible. Yeah, 78s, right. All you heard was that goddamn record scratch. So the thing was, how do you get rid of that? And that was a puzzle that I was just beyond me. I couldn't do it. I didn't know enough math. I didn't know enough real electrical engineering. And effectively, that drove me to college. Let's face it. I want to solve that problem.
That's incredible. So since then, you've had a long, illustrious career, including building a sort of massive antenna so sensitive it could detect faint, invisible ripples in space from 1.3 billion years ago. For those of us not really well-versed in physics, describe the importance of this discovery with LIGO.
Well, first let me say something, that it wasn't me alone who built it. You make it sound like I was this incredible person. A lot of other very good
people.
Let's take cognition of it. What did we discover? Well, we knew black holes existed, but we established that black holes live in pairs.
As a tangent here, what is a black hole?
A black hole is a place, if you were an astronaut and you approached it, very strange things begin to happen to you. The feet get tugged away from your head, and you get stretched apart. And as you go in and in, then you finally get pulled apart. Then the molecules that made you, they get stretched apart. And then even the inside of the molecules get separated into atoms and then into individual pieces. But that whole idea that the geometry is so curled up, and that the strength of gravity is so strong that it breaks up matter, it becomes the strongest thing in the world inside that black hole. So that was one thing. We found out that black holes go together. The other thing is that we found we are able to detect gravitational waves directly. Now, they had been seen before by indirect methods. Very beautiful experiments had shown that they were gravitational waves. But the fact is that you could actually make an instrument that could detect them. And then this, the most important thing to me, that may not be so important to others, is that the Einstein equations, those equations that he struggled over in 1915, and he really agonized over them. He didn't know anything about black holes. He didn't know about this. He didn't know how strong gravity. It worked for gravity that he understood. But here is an extreme case where gravity is all there is, and things are moving damn near the velocity of light, and it still works. And that the equations are still good in that extreme regime, to me is, well, it's, to me, it's just spectacular.
Einstein died, right, kind of frustrated that he wasn't able to kind of go further with this.
I mean, well, even the conceptualization that gravitational waves that carry information and carry energy actually exist in reality, he kept oscillating about that, too. And so I would have, I mean, to me, one of the dreams I have is would have been, had Einstein been still alive, is to tell him about this. I would have loved to see what he would thought about and what his expression would be, you know?
Well, it occurs to me, did you ever feel during your research with the LIGO team and your investigations that you were in some way having a conversation with Einstein?
Well, let me say yes many times, but not because of this. Just the technology that we were able to measure. Very, very tiny motions, smaller than he would have ever imagined. You look at the remarkable things we could do, and Einstein would have been tickled pink by them, I think.
Rainer Weiss, Professor Emeritus at MIT, thank you so much for coming in. Great to meet you.
No, thank you for having me. It was really delightful to talk to you.
Yep, mind officially blown, and that's where we leave things today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.